Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
You know, throughout modern history, people have observed that one of the ways that an oppressor group, whether it's Europeans coming to the Americas or whatever, one of the ways they maintain control is through control of the mind of the oppressed. It's what we, as you point out, we often refer to as internalized oppression, where you start to believe the story of the people who have dominated you.
That's the voice of author and educator Dr. Robert Jensen. On this week's show, we speak to Dr. Jensen about his latest book, Arguing for Our Lives, A User's Guide to Constructive Dialogue. So stay tuned.
And we're very privileged this evening to be joined by Dr. Robert Jensen. He is the author of Arguing for Our Lives. Thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Great to be with you. Thanks, Sylvia.
Wonderful. Now, we live in a world today where, you know, public discourse has become a tool used to create stories that direct us in a world where we're told, you know, capitalism is the only way to organize our society. For instance, the war can be just and that invasions are righteous. And so there's a lot of things that unless we are really aware of, you know, how is it that that story is being framed? How is it that that story is being informed? We feel lost. We're deliberately being misguided. Can we talk a little bit about the need for us to not only be able to be curious about our world, but how do we come to that small T truths that connect the dots and help us make a story that makes sense to us, that is in alignment with who we are?
Well, I think your use of the word story is important, because when we think of the news of the day, the events in the world that are important, we should always remember that there's a bigger story behind it. Take one of the examples you used, capitalism. Whatever the story of the day, whatever the news story of the day, whether it's interest rates going up or the budget or taxes or whatever it might be, there's a bigger story behind it. And one of the key elements of that story in the modern world, in the West, in the developed world especially, but essentially everywhere, is that capitalism is a sort of natural state of being. Well, a simple inquiry reveals pretty quickly that's not true. Capitalism is a product of history. It's a product of choices made really over the last two or three centuries. It's not a natural state of affairs. But if you can tell this bigger story always, that capitalism is natural, then there's no way to critique it, and the news stories of the day have to be dealt with within that capitalist frame. So always going back and asking, what are these bigger stories being told? You mentioned war and the whole idea of just war. If you look at the contemporary Middle East, where a lot of the stories about conflict are emanating right now, the question of Syria, the idea of bringing peace and stability and justice to Syria is not easy. Let's not be naive about this. But the assumption behind a lot of the news stories is that the West, led by the United States primarily, but including the European nations, even Canada, the assumption is that we make the decisions about what level of violence to use to bring that peace and stability and justice to Syria. There's a sort of larger story about the inherent moral superiority of the West and the right of, therefore, the West to make those decisions. That's the big story we have to contest. So the news of the day is important, but the bigger stories are even, I think, in some ways more important.
When I was thinking about what it means for me to be able to understand the story behind the story, you know. Yeah. I often think about, you know, the colonial wound that we all have been born into and that we never speak about. Because if you're in university or if you're in school, sometimes you hear things like, we're in a post-colonial era. And it sounds romantic to think that it's post, that, you know, it's not the same. So what kind of questions should we be asking us when we take this idea that imperialism was something of the past, that colonial power is something of the past, and that we've now transcended or somehow evolved out of that wound of racial?
Yeah, that's a great point, because of course the notion of colonialism, you know, the mainly out of Europe, let's say, the colonial powers literally taking control of other parts of the world, especially in the Americas, let's say the New World. Well, that condition has, of course, changed, and we are post-colonial in some sense. So the countries once ruled by Spain in South America are no longer ruled by Spain. The countries in Africa once ruled by the British or the French or the Germans or the Dutch are no longer ruled by those countries. So in that sense, of course, we are post-colonial. But there's a couple of really important questions you're raising. One is, of course, colonialism was used to describe the direct control, political control, by those European states over the other lands. But although that has changed, the economic relationships are largely unchanged, so that the economies or the former colonial world are still very much controlled out of the West, out of Europe, the United States, for instance. So the question of imperialism is not just about, you know, what kind of direct rule a colonial state might use, but it's how the effective sovereignty of a people is controlled, and that can be done economically as well. I think there's an even deeper way in which we've not transcended the colonial mindset, as you put it. One is, remember, when Europeans came, let's just talk about Canada and the United States, North America, when Europeans came, one of the arguments to justify European colonialism was that the land was not being used, that indigenous people, because they weren't exploiting the land in the same way that Europeans understood that, meant that the land was, in a sense, empty. Of course, there were people here, the indigenous people were here, but because they weren't exploiting the resources in the same way Europeans thought they should be, they, in a sense, had no claim. And that colonial mindset about how to exploit the land, the water, and the air, that's still very much with us. In fact, the entire world is basically based at this point on that conception of exploitation of what we typically call nature. In that sense, we're still locked into the colonial mindset no matter where we live. That's an important reminder, I think, of what we're up against and how things can change on the surface, and underlying dynamics still can be very much in place.
As you were speaking, I was thinking about the way power becomes axiomatic, you know, it justifies itself, right? It becomes self-justifying. So in the case of Latin America, if you're growing up indigenous, you know, it is assumed that your own destiny to be brought into slavery, you know, reflects your inability, your inferiority to the colonizers, right? And so it becomes this this privilege that builds upon itself, and over time the wound becomes internalized. So rather than seeing the history of, you know, rapacity and the violence, you know, that took place, of genocides and the struggles, all we see is ourselves as the reason for our own demise, for our own wounds, for our own poverty. There is this story that unfolds, and it becomes retold and told. And over time, you know, no one even remembers where the story began. We just know that poor people are poor because they're lazy, or, you know, that's the story that sounds palatable, yep, to people who want to justify the system of privilege as it exists. So what would you say to those who have been wounded by too many repetitions of that same story of repression and oppression? How do we break out of it?
Yeah, well, that's a great point. And, you know, throughout modern history, people have observed that one of the ways that an oppressor group, whether it's Europeans coming to the Americas or whatever, one of the ways they maintain control is through control of the mind of the oppressed. It's what we, as you point out, we often refer to as internalized oppression, where you start to believe the story of the people who have dominated you. If you think of, you know, some of the key political social movements of the middle of the 20th century, you know, what we call in the U.S. usually the 60s, this was a central feature. So think about the black liberation struggle in the United States and the assertion that black is beautiful. Well, that was a very real and concrete reminder to people of African descent that white beauty standards were not the only way to understand yourself. And so that black is beautiful for many people literally meant looking in the mirror and remembering that you are beautiful. It may sound trivial in some sense, but it was a, you know, an important recognition along with more traditional political slogans and policies. Of course, with indigenous people in the United States, and again, I typically speak mostly about the U.S. experience, not knowing Canada as well, but the American Indian movement in the United States was not just a political movement, you know, arguing for certain kinds of policies. It was a reclaiming of indigenous traditions. In fact, people referred to themselves as traditionals, those who would no longer accept the idea that Indians should become white to achieve their, you know, greatest potential. And that was very much a part of that struggle as well. You can even think about it in feminist terms, that a lot of feminism was helping women understand that men's definition of them was not the only way to understand themselves. So, you know, this is part of the struggle of every movement that tries to challenge what you pointed out is the naturalizing of domination. And by that, I simply mean the fact that every group of people that's ever tried to dominate another group has tried to make that seem natural, as you pointed out. And fighting that kind of seems obvious once you say it, but it's amazing how that naturalizing of domination, as you're pointing out, can kind of weave itself into the way we think about the world, whether we're on top or on the bottom of that particular dynamic.
You know, I was reading in your book, and you write, we are most free when we are most bound to others. Can you talk a little bit about what this means for you and this idea that the struggle out of this colonized mind, this internalized oppression, it's entangled, it's intertwined with all of us?
Yeah. Well, that's probably one of the most important realizations I think we can come to in the modern world that's defined especially by a capitalist notion of what it means to be a person. And that's another important point, that, you know, behind every political philosophy, every political movement, there's a sense of what it means to be a person, what it means to be human. And in contemporary America, defined by corporate capitalism and mass consumption, you know, people are thought of as being individuals, discrete and completely independent. And in that conception, you know, you are part of a group, part of a society, only to the degree you choose to do it. Your identity is as an individual. Well, that's a very idiosyncratic way of thinking about being human, very modern. For most of human history, people really didn't think of themselves primarily as individuals, but as part of groups. Your identity came from your place, going back to hunting and gathering societies, your place in a band-level society, you know, society that probably had no more than 50 to 150 people in it. Well, that's dramatically different than this individualist, this obsession with the individual we have in the modern world. So when I wrote, we have to realize we are most free when we are most bound to others, it's a challenge to that notion that freedom is in independence, in your separation from others. No human being's life makes any sense separate. We aren't separate. We are social beings, and we get a lot of our sense of ourselves from the surroundings, from not only our social group, but also our place in the larger natural world. And so freedom doesn't come when you're detached from people. Freedom comes from, in my point of view, from understanding your relationship again, not only to other people, but to that larger living world. And for me personally, who, you know, someone who grew up with that very intense sense of individualism, it was a real struggle to recognize that the key is to human life isn't independence, it's a recognition of interdependence with others and with what we tend to call nature.
I was thinking about, you know, this interconnectedness and this this desire to be in community and how painful exile can be. And I wonder if you could talk, because you've written extensively on, you know, the way the violence against women has also become naturalized. And so for me, the question is also, how do we create spaces that are both bounded, but at the same time recognize the inherent value of each person, the uniqueness and beauty that each brings to the whole? And the reason I ask you this question is because as a woman, you are raised to care for everybody. You are raised to be, you know, the caregiver, you know, and so there's a lot of oppression that has been naturalized, and that I feel this sentence taken by itself could be taken to naturalize that process. You know, women are the birthers of, you know, life, and so they should do all the housework and they should care for all the children. And so it becomes this naturalized story that's the culture, that's our culture. We're people who do everything as a group, and so that's the role of the women. How do you speak to your female students who see this call to be bonded and at the same time want to create some spaces where possibilities can emerge for women?
Right. Well, let's go back, because I think these two questions are related. First, to that notion about recognizing our interdependence doesn't mean we're all, you know, clones of each other, that we're somehow just kind of robots and identical. One feminist philosopher I'm fond of many years ago wrote an essay where she talked about the struggle for individuality without individualism. And by that, she meant the kind of honoring of individual differences that you're talking about, because of course we all are distinct and different, and we all bring different kind of qualities to the common life. And so we don't want to erase individuality. We don't want to erase individual variation among human beings. It would be a pretty boring world if we did that. It's this obsession with individualism, this assertion that we are first and foremost separate, that we're trying to challenge, not the idea that people are different. Obviously, people are different, and that's a good thing. So this struggle, I think, is encapsulated very nicely in this phrase, the search for individuality without individualism. The way that plays out in gender, it's an interesting story that patriarchy tells, especially versions of patriarchy, I think, that are rooted in religious ideas. Because if you look at that argument that comes from more traditional religious sectors, they claim that both men and women, both husband and wife in the traditional family that they always value, both of them have obligations, right? The man is the head of the household, and he has obligations to provide, to lead, to guide, and the woman has different obligations to care for the household and all sorts of things. And first of all, we recognize that because there is that individuality, that you can't typecast people so easily. You can't say all men fit this role and all women fit that role, because there's individual variation. It really is rather stifling when you have no choice in the way that you live your life like that. But the other thing is, of course, if you put men in that role and say they have obligations, but you give them all the power to decide, well, the obligations are not going to play out equally, as you're pointing out. And men are naturally, I think, when given that kind of power, going to gravitate toward the misuse of that power, just as any group of human beings given a kind of, you know, unnatural power over others in this sense is likely to abuse it. So what we learn is that, you know, from this example, I think what we learn is that, you know, being human is difficult. It's a struggle. We are individual, yet we are part of a group. We want to fit into roles in a society that help make society stable, but those roles can be stifling, so there's got to be flexibility and creativity in them. I mean, all of this is just a reminder that, you know, being human and having the big brain and having the capacity that we're exhibiting right here, the ability to, you know, have a conversation that's linguistically complex and intellectually complex, that's all very exciting. It also makes life hard sometimes, and that's what we have to struggle with. But the answer is in the struggle, not in pretending this is all very simple, as traditional religion, for instance, wants to do.
Thank you so much for being with us. We've unfortunately run down the clock. We are speaking with Dr. Robert Jensen. His book, Arguing for Our Lives, A User's Guide to Constructive Dialogue. Thank you so much for being with us this evening.
Thanks, Sylvia. Always great to talk.
Thank you.
I'm going to finish out today's show with Drop of Water by Dana Lyons. For more music by Dana Lyons, go to calswithguns.com. Bye for now.
There's a drop of water on the wall, and the drop's about to fall, and it falls into a trickle, and the trickle's flowing down, down, down to the ground, and the moss begins to grow. Watch, 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 watch the water flow, and watch the current become a stream. Busting through the seams, cracking through the concrete, bending down the steel, in a raging that is real, a tearing torrent you can feel. Feel the thunder growing, thunder underground, and in my heart, the chains falling apart, the wildness in my soul. And for once in life, I know I'm not alone. For the mountains make our bones, with the oceans in our blood, our feet planted, planted firmly in the mud. We are alive, the burning embers in our eyes, the tingling touch upon our skin. And in the heat of passion, we begin to understand that we are of this land, that we are part of Earth, and when it's threatened, we will fight for all we're worth. We watch the dam come crashing down, water rushing to the sea. And now the river, now the river, now the river, now is free. Drops about to fall, and it falls into a trickle, and the trickle's flowing down, down, down to the ground, and the moss begins to grow. Watch, 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 watch the water flow, and watch the current become a stream, busting through the seams, cracking through the concrete, bending down the steel, in a raging that is real, a tearing torrent you can feel. Feel the thunder growing, thunder underground, and in my heart, the chains falling apart, water rushing to the sea. And now the river, now the river, now the river, now is free.
come to the end of our program. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program. Please visit our website, www.latinwavesmedia.com, to hear previous shows, connect to our media projects, and access other resources, or to support our efforts by making a safe PayPal contribution. I am Sylvia Richardson. Thanks for listening.